Well, you can say hi if you want to.
Hi, this is
howdy.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, this is Greg LeMond. Welcome to the VeloCast.
That's nice, really nice, yeah.
Hey, hello everyone, and welcome to the VeloCast. The relative high-octane Leave It All on the Road one-day spring classics are over for another year to be replaced with the slow-burn intrigue of the three-week Grand Tour season. And as has been the way of things since 1995 when the Vuelta moved to a late summer start, the Giro d'Italia is the first of the 21-stage behemoths that the men's pro peloton will line up for. The 102nd edition of the Corsa Rossa stays within the Apennine Peninsula, is topped and tailed with two of the three individual time trials included in the race, and covers 3,518 kilometres before the eventual winner of the Maglia Rossa and the Trofea Senza Fine is crowned in Verona on the 2nd of June.
You know, in recent years, we've been talking about the Giro, and we've always commented on how the first rendezvous with the mountains has been surprisingly early. You know, whether it's on one of the islands or on the mainland. I would say that maybe Mauro Venier's got a bit nervous about that, because the first proper rendezvous with the mountains is surprisingly late. Until, I think, stage 13, there's quite a lot of interest. I mean, there are places where you could have an ambush and breakaways can happen. You know, we'll see the odd solo rider come across to the finish on his own. There's some time trial interest for enthusiasts of that particular discipline, and thank you for designing a time trial t-shirt and merchandise that's gone in the shop today, Scott. Much appreciated. But mostly for the GC guys, we're going to get some answers as soon as the wheels hit the road. I mean, tomorrow I think we will get a glimpse into what's happening with the GC guys, physically and mentally. But we're really, I think, going to have to wait until stage 13 until we see the shake-up start. But after that, you know, there's barely a day where they can take the slightest bit of attention off their rivals or the terrain. They have to be on the ball all the time, and they have to get stronger and stronger as the race progresses. It's fascinating and quite unusual, actually, for a modern Grand Tour.
I mean, I was looking at the parkour again this morning, and you know, with that three time trials across the 3 weeks, first one in stage one, last one in stage 21, but stage nine, there's a time trial. And in between stage one and stage nine, we've got arguably a block of sprinter stages, although you're quite right in highlighting how that could be broken up by breakaways and kind of surprise elements across a few of those stages. But with that kind of time trial, sprinter's block, stage nine theme going, I think I could probably just send you the hello everyone, welcome to the VeloCast, and join us again tomorrow, audio recordings, and I'd just take the first week and a bit off.
Well, I recorded a Flamcast with Derek earlier this afternoon, Derek Troy, our friend who's my co-host on the Flamcast, and I said to him, Derek, you should join us for a few of the Giro Daily shows. And of course, what he didn't know is I only said it because I thought, we'll have so little to talk about, we need somebody else in there to keep it interesting.
Not Derek, if you happen to be listening to this, that's not the case. We do love you dearly. But for the sprinters, that first week is going to be fantastic. I want to just briefly touch on, obviously, those two time trials, though. Stage one, as you say, is going to have some impact on the race as soon as the wheels hit the road. It's interesting because not only is it an evening time trial, but it's also a fairly hilly one. As it goes, you know, after a first flat bit to the start of the stage, we go up to the Basilica della Madonna di San Luca in Bologna. So it's not your typical flat, you know, pan flat solely aimed at the purebred time trialists.
No, it's fascinating. I mean, with an 8 kilometre individual time, or 8.7 kilometres, it's too long to be classed as a prologue. Now, it's still a short, sharp effort. The guys are going to be warming up thoroughly on their rollers beforehand, and we'll see that actually later in some of the big mountain stages. You're going to see some guys warming up because it'll go absolutely, you know, batshit crazy from the very start. But for this one, you've got the warm-up to get right. You're nervous. It's the first day of the first Grand Tour of the year. So everything's up in the air, you know, completely unpredictable. You don't know how your rivals are going. You're doing that warm-up. Now, normally you would tailor the warm-up towards just a flat-out effort, you know, just a drag strip race around a prologue. But here you've got the added confusion of having to churn that big gear fast to go, you know, really fast in the flat and often slightly downhill bit in the run up to the final climb. And then that brutal transition to, you know, a climb with top bits are 16%. It's an average of nearly 10%. It's not a short kind of prologue sharp effort. It's a proper climb at the end of this thing. So you've got that nerves, you've got the warm up to get right, you've got the mental attitude to go flat out in the time trial, and then instantly you have to shift your legs, your body position, and your mental attitude to the sheer suffering of a climb. So it doesn't really suit the pure time trial specialists, but the first bit's too fast for the pure climbers. It's going to be a really interesting glimpse into where everybody's form is. Now, it won't tell us everything because this race is so backloaded that people's form is going to have to be concentrated very much in the final week. But I actually think we'll see a guy who will stand on the final step, you know, the top step when the race finally finishes, possibly take the Maglia Rosa in the first individual time trial as well. You know, he could easily bookend the race because I think it's the kind of course that suits a GC guy as opposed to a prologue or time trial specialist.
And I guess you could also say exactly the same of the big time trial in the middle of the race, stage 9, which is 34.8 kilometres long. I mean, it is a protracted version of what we saw or what we will see tomorrow in the opening stage, because it is a reasonably flat start to it before it then leaps off into some climbing at 900 metres of vertical gain, which is concentrated into that latter half of the stage.
It's a Monroe.
Really.
I mean, that's
a Monroe, yes.
That's a proper amount of climbing. The advantage here for the time trial is if they can climb as well, and I'm thinking about people like Primoz Roglic or Tom Dumoulin here, is that it's slightly uphill really from the start. I mean, it's a fast, false flattish start to the thing, but you're in the going uphill, working hard, and you know, against gravity almost from the start. So I think it's much easier to get into the mindset of the route. But with 900 meters of climbing, the pure time trialists and the climbers are going to be very, very evenly matched. So again, this is going to give us a glimpse before we hit the mountains properly in stage 13 of who's really on form. And for people like Simon Yates is the one that springs instantly to mind. He's looking at a Giro with three time trials. Now, on paper, without looking at the parkour, you would instantly think, well, this belongs to Primoz Roglic or Tom Dumoulin. You know, it's a time trialist Giro. And when we heard that Dumoulin was riding it, that was my thought as well before I started to look in depth at the route. But the first two time trials, actually, Yates could maybe not put time into Dumoulin, but certainly limit his losses and aim to capitalise that later in the race. So although they are time trials, I think they're going to be of interest even to, you know, a young climbing whippet like you.
Well, not so young anymore.
Well,
I'm not so climbing.
To me, mate. On both of those.
Well, moving on then to stage 13, which is the race's first summit finish, Pinerolo to Lago Seru. Now, that final climb of the day is 20 kilometres long and maxes out at 14%. So that's going to be a crucial day to really sort out the guys who have brought their climbing legs. Because I think that one of the most interesting dynamics across the entire 3 weeks is going to be the comparative efforts between those who are probably more suited to time trials versus those who are definitely less able in time trials and more suited to pure climbers.
Right, I want you all to imagine that Alejandro Valverde's here. Because he's not. He's got some kind of serious bone thing going on. I mean, it seems horrible. So he's not riding for the team. But what do we say every single year when we're discussing Alejandro Valverde? If it goes above 2,000 metres, he's in trouble. Now, there's a reason for that. Not every rider is capable of performing at their very best when the calls get to the very highest. This has a high point at 2,247 metres. The final climber stretches, long stretches, well over 10%. This is a climber's day. It's the first day in the, you know, in the mountains proper. Well, I've seen glimpses of what people's form is in the time trial, but this is going to be the GC contenders eyeing each other up nervously. It's one of those days where you could easily see a break stick just because the GC guys are nervous and watching each other. And this is where I don't really expect anybody to lose a huge amount of time, although it's not impossible. It's a brutally hard day. but any time lost or gained will really change the mindset of the riders for the days to come. You know, this is a confidence day as much as a pure performance day. And I really expect to come away from stage 13 with an insight into where people's heads are and what we can expect from them in the, you know, the week to follow. I think that show is going to be an absolute marathon because we're going to learn a lot about the riders. The terrain is fascinating. I mean, the high point is just nuts. The final climb is a hard, but it's going to be looking at how they look at each other, how they respond to each other's attacks. If you lose 30 seconds, 40 seconds, your head's going to be mince going into the next day. You know, if you manage to gain a few seconds, you're going to be buoyant. You're going to be ready to attack when the race gets hard. So this is, mentally for me, it's a real turning point for the race as much as the physical aspect.
And straight on to that next day then, stage 14, 131 kilometres from Saint-Vincent to Courmayeur. So a relatively short stage by Giro standards, which is known for its really, really long stages at times. This has got four climbs, and following the descent from the Colle San Carlo, there's then the ride up to the finish at Skyway Monte Bianco ski station.
Can we all have a GC rider cliche drink? Because I'm going to say I could see Vincenzo Nibali descending like a stone off that final high peak. either to catch a group that's going away or to force a break, actually. I think Nibali, he's talking a good game. We've seen him in the run-up at the Tour of the Alps and stuff. He's showing good form this year. I think he's coming to this main objective of the year with real intent. And normally you would look at this and think, I really wish it was a summit finish. But when you've got riders capable of pushing it on a technical descent, then Nibali will be looking at this day as an opportunity. If he's gone well the previous day, he's going to push like a devil on that descent. And then you've got the wee kick up again to Courmayeur as the very finish line. So if a small group do get away, either on the climb of that of the San Carlo or on the descent, there's going to be a wee fight in the run into the finish as well. And their legs are going to be tired. I mean, their legs are just going to be absolutely shattered after the day before. So again, it's part of that building process. But you're going to start to see, I think, bigger gaps in the GC form on stage 14.
Now, once we do the deja vu of Lombardia on stage 15, which finishes, of course, in Como, that then takes us on to the next.
We can get a good half hour just waxing lyrical about the scenery in that stage.
Well, Dean Martin sings in the background. to stage 16, though, which is another crucial GC day. Loferra to Ponte di Legno, 226 kilometres, comes straight after the second rest day, and will present us with that age-old, will anyone have blocked legs? And of course it will also present us with the infamous climbs of the Gavia and Mortarolo.
This is for me the pivotal day of the race. This is the day where I think we might see two or three people emerge as the final podium, and the question as we move forward will be who can cement their place in the top step as opposed to, you know, the second or the third. We might see a time trialist who loses little enough time that, bearing in mind we're only a few days away from that final time trial, he fancies his chances, as Tom Dumoulin did when he won his Giro, you know, using the late time trial to overtake time he'd lost in the mountains. We might see a climber like Simon Yates having gained enough time to fancy his chances in that final time trial. But, you know, absolutely mythical climbs. A hard finish after, you know, a sawtooth profile all day, deep into the race, the fatigue of those hard mountain stages we've already talked about. After the rest day, you know, cliche number three, I think, of the show, your legs might be blocked, nobody knows how they go after the rest day. We're going to see the pack really whittled down for potential winners when we get to the finish of the race. This is a day, I say it for every Grand Tour, if you have to take one day as a sickie for work, it's stage 16 of this Giro.
And I would also say that stage 20 could probably come into that as well, although I guess that's at the weekend, so you only need to take a ticket if you work weekends, folks. Feltre to Croce d'Aunne is 193 kilometres long and a real decisive day in the Dolomites.
Do you know, this is really funny, because if you look at the next day, it's kind of like, you're not a time trialist, but it's like the Kirk Liston 10 course, except slightly longer, which anybody who's ridden that will know what I mean. You know, big climb in the middle, then big descent. Hideously hard to pace. but the kind of thing where you want to save your energy. You know, you really want to save your energy. So you're thinking, they'll put in a nice recovery stage before the time trial so that the guys can prep for it properly. Instead, you've got a stage where if you don't go full gas, you're going to lose the race. You know, these 2 days are a really fascinating block of racing, because 20 on its own would be a magnificent stage before a parade day. You know, it would be a race where nothing was left on the road, where everybody was pouring their heart out to try and get a victory in the knowledge that it would be, you know, glasses of Prosecco and bits of pizza or whatever and gelato on the road into some big touristy Italian town the next day. But instead, the next day, you've got another time trial where you need to perform. You know, if you're a climber, you need that buffer against the time trialists. So you've got a stage 20 where the profile is just evil, with a harder finish than, you know, the stage we talked about, stage 16. But you've got a time trial the next day. What do you do? And bear in mind, at this point, they're also completely in the bucket. You know, they're at the end of a brutally hard final week of a Grand Tour, having ridden for 3 weeks. The riders don't know how their bodies will respond. Their DSs can make the best laid plans and have no idea if they're going to work. And as fans, I've got an idea who I think are going to win, but these 2 days could change everything. You know, you blow in that final climb in stage 20, you're screwed for the time trial. It's a big conservation of energy and management of your body day. And these guys have to know their bodies to plan for this kind of thing. And even if you do, it could all go wrong if you have to dig extra deep on stage 20.
Yeah, and stage 20, as you're saying there, it's not just the brutal finish, it's those four categorised climbs right across the day. The Cima Campo, which is relatively benign in comparison to what follows it, the Passo Mengen, which tops out over that mythical 2,000 metres. It's what, 19 kilometres long. Once you've done that, you've got a long descent before you start climbing up the 20 and a half kilometre long Passo Rolla, which is slightly more forgiving, with a maximum gradient of 10%. But those two back to back, I think, are going to really, really sap the energy of anybody looking to survive to the end. And as you say, when you couple that with the 17 kilometre ITT around Girona, with that really unwelcome lump right in the middle before they get to the Roman amphitheatre at the end, it's a real, real juggling act. And more about the, you know, chess within a game of chess on wheels that we come to know and love of cycling Grand Tours.
No, it's beautifully balanced. And you add the fatigue, it's completely unpredictable. You know, if you're a pure climber, you're going to have a big chunk of time to stop the likes of Tom Dumoulin or Primoz Roglic hoovering you up in that time trial. But if you're one of those time trial specialists, your legs have to be absolutely on top form to hang with the pure climbers in stage 20. It's, you know, you and I, when we've argued over the years about whether we prefer time trials or climbs or whatever, we've got valid differences of opinion based largely around the type of riders we are. You know, that's what you tend to prefer. But we've always talked about balance. And that's what this finale for this Giro has. It's beautifully balanced between the climbers and the time trial specialists. And whoever wins this Giro will know they've won it. You know, they're going to have to go absolutely as deep as it's possible for a human to go, be tactically astute, have a good team around them, have DSs who are on the ball, know what they're doing, have mechanics who prepare their equipment perfectly, make the right bike and gearing choices for the time trials. It's going to have to be the complete package that wins. It's astonishing. We should also mention, just again, because I think we're legally obliged every time Croce Don appears on our route, it's where Tullio Campagnolo invented the quick release.
It is indeed, and I think there's a monument to the man himself at that point. And the race, now on now to the all-important question of who, of course, will be vying for that coveted Maglia Rossa when the race reaches Verona on the 2nd of June. I guess we've mentioned a couple of the names already thus far, but it would be rude of us not to start with Tom Dumoulin, who, you've got to say, if you'd asked Dumoulin to design a Grand Tour, it it probably wouldn't be too dissimilar to what RCS have presented here. I guess the main difference would be that, that Tom would have likely preferred these stages to be north of the border and for the race to be called the Tour de France.
Yeah, and a bit flatter, it's good to be said. Mark Florence, our friend who produces a rather excellent time trial podcast, asked me why I thought, you know, so many of these really top GC contenders that we see riding here aren't riding the Tour, because the Tour's starting to look, or started to look, a bit like the, you know, the poor relation in terms of quality of GC field. I think they're just scared of Chris Froome and Geraint Thomas. I think they've looked at team, or the team that formerly was known as Sky, and looked at the strength and depth they've got at the sharp end and the leadership point, and I've just assumed that if one of those guys falters, the other will step up and they've got a better chance of winning the Giro d'Italia. We've lost Egan Bernal, who was one of my picks, but Tom Dumoulin is on everybody's lips as one of the favourites. My only worry is I don't think we've seen Tom firing on all cylinders this year. There seems to be something slightly off in his performance. Maybe he's lost a bit of sharpness in his time trials. But we won't have to wait long to find out, because tomorrow's time trial, if you think about, you know, the time trial in Bergen, where you had all of that fast stuff followed by a brutal climb, Tom showed us there that he's capable of the kind of attitude and physicality that can tackle a course like that, which was far more demanding than this because it was much longer. So if he's on song tomorrow, wins it and pulls on the Maglia Rosa, we know that he's in form. I need to see him perform. I've got this niggling doubt about Tom Dumoulin. And I also think the final week, although his climbing is far beyond what it used to be, that final week against the likes of Simon Yates, if Yates learns from last year's mistakes, might just be a bit hard for Tom. So he's one of the favourites, but he's by no means on his own in the top step for me.
And I guess the other question that you could be forgiven for asking is, how much has that Sunweb winter exodus that we talked about before affected Tom Dumoulin's ability to compete in a Grand Tour? I mean, does he have the team? You look through the roster, or the lineup rather, for Sunweb going to this race across the next 3 weeks. It doesn't, I mean, Sam Ooman is a fantastic domestique who I think Dumoulin will rely on a great deal, but it's not the same quality of names that you
There's no Lawrence Tindam, is there?
Exactly that. There's nobody that you know will be at Tom's side no matter what. It just seems a little more fragile than it once was.
Yeah, I mean, I've got questions about Tom Dumoulin and his challenge. I almost expected Tom to make bigger strides after he won his Giro. And that's not to put him down. I mean, he's a magnificent rider, one of my favourites, because essentially he's a tester who's morphed into a GC guy. But I've got my niggles. I don't know. I just don't know. And I hope that we see him absolutely lay down a performance tomorrow that makes us think, yeah, he's in there. Let's see what he can do once the race hits the mountains.
Well, probably the top favourite for the race, Primoz Roglic, which is ironic given what we've just said about Tom Dumoulin and course design. But Roglic is clearly in stellar form, as we've seen from the recent Tour of Romandy. But, and if you're continuing to play cycling bingo at home, folks, be sure to get your cards and big marker pen at the ready. Has he peaked too soon?
I don't think he's peaked too soon. I think he'll have a bad day, though. There's a big difference between winning Tirreno and, you know, he's won every stage race he's turned up at this year, and performing over 3 weeks with particularly such a hard back-loaded race as this. If you look at the performance that he had at Romandy, you would think that's a hot favourite. And purely on form, it is. You know, it really wouldn't surprise. He's probably my favourite for the first individual time trial tomorrow. You know, the kind of form he's coming into the race with, combined to the fact that he's a strong time trialist and a very strong climber, he's my pick to pull on the first Maglia Rosa of the Giro tomorrow. But he's one of those guys, like Ilnur Zakarin, who's down a good few rungs from where he used to be in terms of expectations. You kind of expect him to have a bad day. If he doesn't, he's rampant favourite for this race because he just looked magnificent in Romandy. And is a strong time trialist and capable of climbing with the very best. So he's got everything that's needed. But my niggle is I think he's going to have a bad day.
Now on to somebody who had a very, very bad day in this race last year. Although you were telling me just before we started recording that our good friend Dan Freeb had posted some... some pre-race comments from Simon Yates, which actually made me warm to Simon Yates a whole lot more than I already am. Would you like to regale the listeners with what Dan was saying?
Well, Yates was asked, who do you think's the favourite for the Giro? And he just said, me. Which is such a refreshing change from, oh, I've got bad legs, but I'll do my best, you know. I don't know where I am. I had a yogurt in February and I haven't felt the same since.
I really respect all the other riders who are here and, you know, I've got to take them seriously. No, I mean, again, just kind of highlighting a conversation we had. There's something really nice about that, just sheer arrogance. Even if you end up performing spectacularly badly, I think it's quite refreshing to hear somebody go, no, I'm coming here to win it. How dare you suggest otherwise?
Yeah, and I he's one of my joint favourites for the overall. We saw last year in the Vuelta that he'd learned from that horrible day he had when Chris Froome took the race by the scruff of the neck on the Finestra climb, and you know, the rest is, as they say, history. It would have been easy for Simon to be crushed by that, because he'd looked like an absolute nailed-on winner of the Giro. But instead, we've got a man who, for Mitchell and Scott, won a Grand Tour in 2018 and who looks perfectly capable of winning two on the trot. You know, he's strong, his team are strong, him and his brother have been performing well in the lead-up to this race, but not so well that you have the has-he-peaked-too-early worry. He's got the right mental attitude. He showed that in coming back to win the Vuelta last year. And the uphill time trials, I think, will suit him far more than if you'd given Tom and Primoz a flat drag strip to put time into him. So Yates is ready. The course suits him. If he can get through those difficult early days without stacking in at a ditch or hitting somebody's wheel or something, and hits the mountains ready to party, he's up there with Primoz Roglic, which is a hot favourite for me.
Well, I'd like to just maybe throw in a cautionary tale as regards Simon Yates and the assertion that he's learned from his Giro lesson by now being more conservative and would say to that argument, well, look how I won the Vuelta. I think it's maybe quite dangerous to assume that all Grand Tours are equal for all riders. The Vuelta just isn't the Giro.
No, and the Giro's not the Tour.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you can win the Vuelta, it doesn't necessarily translate to coming back to the Giro and knocking it out of the park. Personally, I'd love to see that. But, well, the uphill nature of the three time trials, you say, suit him a wee bit more, I would absolutely agree with. I still think he's at a disadvantage given the number of them.
Yeah.
And given how much that the mountains are stacked within the final week, it causes me to have a slight bit of concern over what he'll have to do in order to stem the flow of time that he may have lost in the two previous time trials, meaning he would have to attack those mountain stages like an absolute lunatic, which then suggests that there's the possibility he could crack spectacularly again. I mean, I don't think he will this year, but there's maybe a few more questions I've got about Simon Yates, which is leading me to think, I don't think he's going to win the Giro.
And I tell you, actually, I mean, the other thing that you have to consider if you're Simon Yates and the Mitchell DSs is you have to remember how he gained his time last year, and it was by being almost recklessly aggressive. Mm-hmm. They can't tone it down so much that he doesn't have that.
Mm.
You know, so it's a very difficult balance. He has to go in the attack in the way that you're talking about in the final week, but he has to rein it back enough that he doesn't have a jour sans like he did in the Finestra day. So, I mean, it's a difficult balance for him, but there's a calmness about him and that quiet arrogance that I think bodes well as we move into the race. If he doesn't win it, it'll be because he's cracked spectacularly, I think.
Mm. Now, Vincenzo Nibali, looking at the route, you'd maybe conclude that the shark is unlikely to feature prominently here, and that's as sure a clue as any that Vincenzo will have some manner of last-minute heist up his Bahrain Merida jersey sleeve.
2.5 minutes in stage 20 hangs on to win by 3 seconds after the time trial. Telling you. It's going to be, I mean, he looks in form. He's talking a great game. It's his sole big objective for the year. You know, I was reading in an interview where he said he's really missed winning. The last time he won was Milan Sanremo last year. It's been too long. And he's addicted to winning. He's prepped properly. His numbers are right. The team, although not the strongest, I'd argue are better than, say, Sunweb, and being set up to support Vincenzo. I wouldn't bet on him, but I wouldn't bet against him. Mm. I mean, he's a grand champion for a reason.
Yeah, I mean, and if there's one rider in the current peloton, or certainly in this race, who you would argue is able to ride himself into form at a Grand Tour, it's Vincenzo Nibali, isn't it?
Yeah, no, 100%. It's one of the things I'm really looking forward to in this race, and there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot that I'm looking forward to in this race, is seeing how Vincenzo, you know, how his game plan pans out. It's going to be fascinating.
I don't expect to see or hear from him for the best part of 2.5 weeks.
Yeah. Stay out of trouble, keep his nose out the wind, maybe have a wee dig to show the others he's there, but not enough to burn too many matches. And then when the shit hits the fan, he'll be there.
Yeah. Miguel Angel Lopez, third in last year's event, and is actually looking a much better prospect than he was 12 months ago. And I think it's also worth noting that his team, Astana, can equally be filed in that looking a much better prospect than they were last year category.
Oh, that's a really interesting dynamic at Astana. They've got Miguel Angel Lopez. He's looked absolutely fantastically strong. They're a team absolutely on the they're top in terms of morale. They've had a fantastic spring. And you look at him and you look at Egan Bernal, and when I was looking at the race before Bernal was so cruelly popped out of it by breaking his collarbone, I could so easily see a combine between them to put time into the others, you know, a kind of Colombian 1-2 where they would take the race apart and then sort it out amongst themselves. We might still see that with the likes of Sosa in EOS. Miguel Angel Lopez could certainly win this. You know, he's got the class, he's got the team behind him, but he's kind of a dark horse for me. Astana at some point have to falter, they just do, and it might be Miguel Angel Lopez at the Giro, but he's, you know, he's shown he can perform at the highest level before. He's one of my kind of three-star guys. I expect him to be top five, solid top five, likely to make the podium. I kind of find it hard to see him winning, but he could easily surprise me.
Now, Mikel Landa, of course, more he's been responsible for more cries of freedom than a Braveheart cosplay party. There's still, of course, the rumours ongoing that he's once again about to jump ship as the musical chairs of team leadership get shifted round again, Vincenzo Nibali being at the heart of Landa's ability to move elsewhere. But he's actually looked very good this year, good at Zulia and Liège-Bastogne-Liège. But I don't know whether the summit finish to TT stage ratio is going to suit him.
It's fascinating. I mean, if we get the Mikel Landa that we've seen when he was at his very best, they could suit him. You know, they absolutely could. And Movistar have an interesting thing going on where also in the group that they're making turn up for the Giro is Richard Carapaz, who was fourth last year. So you've got a 1-2 attack, but it's not the kind of nonsensical trident where you had three guys who all wanted to win in the Tour last year. So they can play with the Carapaz-Landa thing. And I think nobody expects Landa to be, you know, absolutely on the top step of the podium. So they might get a bit more freedom. It's, all joking aside, it's time for him to prove himself. We saw his engine when he was at Astana. You know, we saw that he had the talent to get a big contract and move to another team. But there's been too much moaning. There've been too many excuses. At some point, he has to put up or shut up. And this Giro, for me, is the point where he has to do that. And with Carapaz in the team and a decent backup team, he's got everything at his disposal that he needs for a good performance. if he doesn't win, he certainly has to podium to retain some credibility and keep his salary high, I think.
Now, you talked about Team Ineos there and the sad loss of Egan Bernal, because I think he would have been an intriguing prospect into the mix of everything we've discussed here. The team itself is, of course, looking really bizarre given the status of the squad versus who they've actually been able to put up for this. I still think there's something in GC to be done for Team Ineos, because you talked about Ivan Sosa, but I think you've also maybe got to put, although he's very very young yet, Pavel Sinikov, who performed so well at Tour of the Alps recently. Plus you've got Sebastian Hanau and Theo Geoghegan-Hart. So while there's not an out and out favourite, someone of huge cycling stature, the likes of Chris Froome or Geraint Thomas, or even the burgeoning reputation of Egan Bernal in it, I think they've actually got quite a few cards to play in that squad.
Yeah, I mean, as soon as I heard about Bernal's injury and looked at the team, in fact, you and I talked about it before we recorded this week, we might even have talked about it when we did record. My thought was, this is a chance for somebody to do a breakout ride. You know, one of those rides that either gets Dave Brailsford to sit up to attention and put them on the track for, you know, next GC leader, or gets them a big contract from another squad. Sosa's an awesome talent. But we saw with Sivakov and Theo Geoghegan-Hart at the Tour of the Alps, and I'm not comparing, you know, a 4 or 5 day race to a 3 week Grand Tour, but they had the horsepower. You know, and they had the tactical savvy to really take that race by the horns, and really, you know, brilliant victory for Sivakov. Great performance from Theo Geoghegan-Hart. So I expect one of those three, and maybe Sebastian Hanau, although a bit less so from him, to have the support of a team that's still really strong. You know, you look at that team, it would have been perfectly capable of supporting Egan Bernal if he had been, you know, well enough to turn up at the start line. And to establish themselves in the road, get the team behind them, a top 10 would be a huge success for any of them. I could easily see them nipping into the top 5, though. You know, I genuinely think we're going to see a performance that makes us go, wow, that's a young guy who's got a really bright future ahead of him, from the likes of Ivan Sosa or Sivakov.
Now, before we move on, just to briefly touch on the sprinters who will be showcasing their wares, I guess, in the first week. Is there anybody else GC-wise that you want to just touch on?
Bob Jungels. Just because I like Bob Jungels, I don't think he's going to do anything of note. He'll likely finish top 10. But the time trials will actually suit him. There was talk of the transition to the cobbles because he says he can never get light enough to be a proper GC guy. But I think I could easily see him snipe a wee stage or two and finish top 10.
So those sprinters then, I guess the first person we need to talk about is Elia Viviani. I mean, his 4 stages at last year's event is the building blocks by which he dominated the points jersey competition. And there's one specific factor that's different this year, who, you know, we'll talk about in a moment or two, that makes a very different jersey competition for Elia Viviani this year. But that being said, he still is, I guess, the guy that everybody will be looking to beat over on the sprinter stages.
I think so. The only thing I'd say is I don't think the team are quite as focused on getting him across the line first as they maybe were. So he's in possibly the second most horrible Italian Champions jersey I've ever seen in my life. Have you seen it?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm totally in agreement with you.
And our chum Fabrizio, one of our chums on Twitter, pointed out that at least the flag's the right way up this time. It's usually sideways in the Italian Champions jersey. But it just, I mean, he looks like a tube of toothpaste. It's just wrong. But he's one of the three guys, I think, who will dominate the sprint. And if one of them gets their tail up, then you get that kind of cascade of wins that follows. If Viviani starts well, he'll carry on well. If he gets his arse handed to him a couple of times, then one of the other top guys, I think, will take, you know, a whole raft of stages, actually, in the first week, 10 days. He's a talent. He'll be in his national champions jersey and his national tour. He's going to be motivated. I think the team could have been stronger for him, but he's a classy enough sprinter. He might be able to work around that.
I'm just wondering if anybody's done a correlation between when the Italian flag was the wrong way round in some way, shape or form on the national champions jersey and when Silvio Berlusconi was in power. You know, essentially a kind of coded message to say the country's in trouble.
Aye, or, you know, bunga bunga party or whatever. I saw a quote for Berlusconi today. I'm not going to talk about Berlusconi. I'll get angry. Let's move swiftly along to the next one.
Okay, and given the person we're talking about, I can only imagine what manner of quote it would be. Caleb Ewan, then, another sprinter that will be looking to take some stages.
First Grand Tour for his new team. Took the Mark Cavendish, let's see if I can get my nose to scrape off my front tyre style of sprinting to its logical conclusion. Fast guy, but runs on confidence more than any of these others, I think. You know, if he starts winning, then just as I said with Viviani, he'll keep winning. I think Caleb Ewan could really move up as a force in sprinting in this Grand Tour. There are some guys who aren't there who would normally cause some trouble for him. To be honest, I think there's only three proper sprinters at the very front edge of sprinting that have turned up for this race. And Ewan's one of them. So I hope Kelly does a brilliant ride for Lotto. He deserves to get some time alone in the limelight.
And the third of that trio, and the certainly the different factor that we're facing this year in terms of Elia Viviani is Fernando Gaviria. Of course, Gaviria was a teammate of Viviani last year, now the rivals. And the battle between the two of them is going to be absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, Gaviria hasn't looked on song for me this year. We've seen some clever racing for him where he's ridden well for teammates. But I don't think we've seen the Fernando Gaviria that just absolutely precluded the idea of anybody else winning at the Giro a couple of years ago. If he comes on song in the Giro, I think Gaviria is the natural successor to the likes of Mark Cavendish for me. He's the most natural raw talent in sprinting that I've seen for a long time, and tactically very, very savvy. I really hope he comes on song, because if we get all three of those guys, and you can add in people like Pascal Ackermann, even if I think that other than the sponsorship thing and the fact that a German team, Bora, were absolutely mental to leave Sam Bennett at home. You know, you'll get those guys poking their noses out from time to time, but that big triptych of sprinters at the front, if they're all three of them in song, we're in for some treats in the early days of this Giro.
And it's sad. I mean, I know we keep barking on about this, but I would have put Sam Bennett, given how good he's been over the past 12 months, in amongst that trio to make a quartet of
every
sprinters
of
every who would have been fighting it out every stage. There was an opportunity for them. So with yourself, I'm just utterly bemused by looking at the other rosters that are lining up and not seeing Sam Bennett as being a shoe-in for a couple of those stages, if not all of them, if things went his way. Why would you leave a sprinter of that talent at home against the competition that he's facing? It's just bizarre.
Yeah, he's shown time and time again in the last year. Last year's Giro, he was magnificent. And this year he's shown that he's capable of beating the best when they're at their best. And we can't actually say that of Pascal Ackermann this year. I think it's purely the fact that Bora are a German company. They want the German rider there. But if I'd been Denk, then Bennett would have been in my squad.
Now, it's come that really, really horrific time where someone will point out 3 weeks hence just how ridiculously wrong we were in predicting X to win. So who is your X for the Giro d'Italia 2019?
Simon Yates.
I thought it was going to be, just by the way you were talking, that you were going to prompt for Simon Yates. And it's in no way a crazy suggestion. I do think he is amongst the very top favourites, and that confidence that you were talking about will serve him well. The queries I've raised, I did so. But it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest to see Simon Yates win back-to-back Grand Tours. Having said that, I think I'm going to go with Primož Roglič simply by the form that he's in, although I do accept all the caveats that you highlighted as to why he may not end up with a Maglia Rossi at the end of this. And there's just a big question mark over Tom Dolan, his form, and his team for me. So I'll cast my lot in with Primož Roglič.
Do you know the really interesting thing is I've talked to quite a few people actually over this last week about who they think is going to win, and nobody's picked Tom Dumoulin.
I mean, that is bizarre when you think about it, that he essentially shooed the biggest race of the year for whatever reason, whether it's fear of the Team Ineos duo and the parkour that's presented there, or indeed just simply a preference towards the three individual time trials that are thrown up here. But not to have picked Tom Dumoulin as a winner across all the people that you've perhaps spoken to in the past week or so is strange. But I would actually have to kind of agree with him at this stage in time, just, you know, 24 hours before the Giro gets underway. But I come back to what you were saying, and I think it's a great point. Until we see Tom's finishing time on that relatively short stage in Bologna tomorrow, we just don't know how he's going to be.
No, and I really hope that, you know, when we come to stage, we're sitting here doing a daily show for stage 17 or something, that we can look back and say, well, we were wrong about that. Because I love Tom Dumoulin. As I say, a tester who becomes a GC guy. What's better? You know, I mean, it's absolutely the best kind of rider in the world, other than, you know, maybe Bernardino. But I've got this niggle about the way he looks. And it's not even how he looks on the bike. It's just when he's sitting round, you see him talking to people. There's not the high energy that we had even after, you know, nipping to the toilet behind a sign when he won his Giro. It's just, there's something not right about Tom, and I hope I'm wrong, because he is one of my favourite riders.
Now, you briefly touched on this right at the top of the show, and I want to spend just a minute or two discussing the kind of all-new Velocast shop, where you can buy all manner of sweetly designed apparel.
Yeah, I mean, you've knocked it out of the park again, mate. We launched our Giro merchandise. There's mugs, there's different T-shirts, different sweatshirts. I put out just one tweet about it this morning, and they've been selling like hotcakes since then. I'm going to have to go in and make sure that all the administration's done for the sales so that people can get them in time to, you know, wear them in support before the riders hit the mountains. So you can visit shop.velocast.cc, have a look at the new merchandise. Scott's designs are always, you know, it's one of the reasons I stick with him, even when he's troublesome. And they're particularly good for this Giro. Go and have a look.
Do you know, it struck me, and I couldn't believe it, I'd never done a time trial T-shirt. I mean,
I bought one of the mugs.
I thought you might.
I actually spent proper money and bought one of the mugs.
And it's not because I'm, you know, so against time trials that I would, you know, forbid myself of designing anything. It's just, it never occurred to me. It's like, why isn't there a time trial T-shirt? So the one I've designed has got a stopwatch on it and Contre la Montre, which I guess is kind of at odds with the Giro d'Italia being the theme, as that's what the French would call the time trial. But yeah, I just thought it was time we had a time trialing T-shirt and hoodie for sale. So as John says, go to shop.velocast.cc and fill your boots, folks.
I want it on a skin suit when I do a 27-minute 10.
That can be arranged. It may be ill-advised for the watching public, but that certainly can be arranged.
Oh, man, that would be embarrassing, wouldn't it?
Anyway, that's our look ahead to the 102nd Giro d'Italia. We will, of course, be back following every single stage of this race, and we trust that you'll join us as we start our Italian odyssey in the next edition of The Velocast.